So, you know, we had decided to kind of blow through 1979 and get on to 1980, where there's a lot of really good, rich stories.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when I looked at 1979, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the second Van Halen album.
Right. Absolutely.
Because that was just an extremely strong album.
How long did it take them to do that? I have a feeling they kind of knocked it out pretty fast.
They did, even
for that era of time of recording.
They did. And I don't have like inside intel on this, but I would imagine some of the songs that didn't make it to the first album were either put on the second album or retooled for the second album.
Yeah.
It was like they had a lot of material.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And this time around, you know, they had an opportunity to play off of the success that they'd have already created.
Right. So I almost have a feeling, I may be completely off on this, but you wouldn't want to lead off with a double album, but I bet Van Halen had enough to kick it off with a double album, which might have been Van Halen 1 and 2.
They could have. I mean, they certainly probably could have. And, you know, if we could get Noel Monk to do an interview with us, he would tell us exactly what was going on.
I mean, after getting Kenny Kushnick on the show, I think anything's possible now.
Yeah, that was a great show.
That was a great show.
I mean, that was a great episode, and that was another record that is on my list, is the debut album for the Pretenders.
Yeah,
which Kenny had talked about how they got signed and whatnot. And by the way, we need to bring Ava back.
Oh. What did we say something wrong, or you just miss her?
Both. First of all, I miss her.
Yeah.
And second of all, when we were talking about the episode, I think it was 1979.
Yeah.
And we had talked about Bill Ham sharing the new artwork for a brand new ZZ Top album, and it was in the sand dunes of West Texas.
Right.
And it was El Loco was the album cover.
Okay.
So if you go to that album cover, you're going to see them standing in all this white sand.
Gotcha.
And we had brought up something that another album that didn't even, like, wasn't even close. So this was probably one of my more embarrassing cleanups.
Well, let's have Ava.
Clean up on aisle two.
Okay. There you go.
Okay. I'm feel better.
Feel better about yourself?
I do.
It's kind of like getting a, I don't know, like, I wanted to say enema, but that's probably not appropriate.
Clean up on aisle two.
You just have that nice cleanse feeling after that.
So. I don't know. It might be appropriate. We just worked our way past Thanksgiving, so that might be very appropriate.
That's good.
So when I was, there's a couple things I was going to talk about, you know, because I do have some stories that I could share, but we have a listener that's important to us. Bruce Walden, and he gets a little tired of our Van Halen stories. So this is where we might have to ask him to just mute for a minute.
Just for a minute there,
just
Bruce.
Just for a minute. But what had happened is we are coming off of the first album, and we were on our way to the second album for Van Halen.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a opportunity for me to kind of turn my friends on to Van Halen, because they had a date in Toledo, Ohio, and it was May 8th, and the reason I remember that, it was Alex's birthday.
Okay.
And again, the reason I have a lot of Van Halen stories is because, A, we're exactly the same age, you know, within a year apart, and we all were with Warner Brothers at the very same time. So so Toledo is like 45 miles south of Detroit. And this was like a perfect time for me to turn my best buds onto the band. So in one of the episodes, I told you guys about my friend Bruce Wilson, who had driven past me out the sunroof of his car,
right,
steering with his toes.
Right.
And then Glenn Kirby, who had this punk, a company called Sure Shot Productions, and he was booking all the really great new wave and punk bands in a gay bar called Bookies.
Right.
So I got those guys to come down, and I told them, I said, look, here's the Holiday Inn we're going to be in, so, you know, secure your rooms, come on down, and let's have some fun. So we were on the Holiday Inn, and David Lee and Bruce were going at it at the pool table, and Pete Angelus and Will, the guitar tech, are doing shots at the bar, and Glenn is knee-deep in conversation with Michael Anthony, and we're all just kind of killing time before the show.
Your friends must have thought you were the coolest guy in the world.
At that moment, I think I was.
Yeah,
if
no
I look
doubt.
Back, I would have wanted to be my friend, too.
Exactly,
you
man.
Know? So it ends up, you know, being another beautiful spring day in Ohio. And the, you know, the band is, you know, we're going to have another party in the hotel. So after the show, which was an incredible show, you know, we all go back to the hotel room. And for some reason, we're going to celebrate Alex's birthday in my room.
Oh.
And the very first thing that happens is they go and open the windows as wide as they can.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, it's a nice, you know, night out. It's
let the breeze
it's
in.
A spring night in May. And then here comes my mattress. And
oh,
then there goes
no.
the frame. And, you know, at the time, Holiday Inn would have these lamps that were attached to a table.
Yes, yeah.
Well, somehow that got, like, karate kicked in half, and everything ended up out onto the ground below. And I don't even know back, you know, I look back at this sort of thing and go, well, what are the managers of the hotel?
Yeah, because there wasn't really that much security like you see today. It was basically the person behind the desk, and that's kind of it, you know?
In Toledo, Ohio.
In Toledo, of course,
and
right?
then you have other guests. I mean, what are they thinking when they're looking out and seeing things flying past their room? Needless to say, we partied so hard, and I remember clearly being involved in different parties in different rooms, but I remember this girl. And the reason I remember her so well is she was just this beautiful blonde girl that was very healthy,
mm-hmm.
if you know what I mean. Healthy
yeah,
in
right.
the chest.
Yeah. Nice lungs.
Nice lungs. And everybody was trying to hit on this poor girl. And so I saw David Lee Roth with his arm around her doing his magic.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, and we're going different rooms grabbing different alcohol.
Right.
And then all of a sudden I see Alex with her.
Wow.
And everybody, you know, I saw her all the time with somebody. For the most part, other people tend to lose articles of clothing. She kept hers on all night long, and we were all kind of surprised that she wouldn't disappear.
Right.
Not to be seen till the following day.
Yeah.
Well, needless to say, my room, when I got back to it, because I think I ended up passing out in someone else's room, was literally covered in beer cans. Like, I've never seen this in my entire life, but like every inch of my floor in my hotel room was covered with beer cans. I look and there's somebody sleeping in my bathtub. I mean, there's stragglers.
Nice.
And I'm immediately like, where's my luggage? And I was smart enough to like hide it under the, well, not my bed. Where did I put it? Because
yeah,
most of my stuff ended up downstairs. But somehow, all that was intact. And at the end of the day, I'm downstairs with my buddies.
Yeah.
And we're having breakfast. And
they let you stay in the hotel after all this debauchery.
Well, the first thing I did once because I was really, really hungover. And this must have been 10, 11 in the morning when we finally, and the band had already left. They
okay.
were on their way to Buffalo, New York. And the reason I know that is because the first thing I did is I went to the hotel manager and said, for the love of God, take all of these charges off my credit card. Because this is not me. This is a very successful rock band.
Right.
Put all that destruction on their stuff.
Right.
And then we're sitting there, and here comes this girl.
Oh.
And my buddies and I are just, you know, we're, you know, laughing about the night before, and just we have all these stories to share. And there she is, and we call her over and we go, what's going on? And she said, I'm supposed to be on their bus.
Oh.
And I said, hold on. I said, guys, excuse me for a minute. And I grabbed her and we went privately and went and talked. I said, what's up? She said, I was going to be their person that did their laundry and kept everything in order. And I said, who told you that? And she couldn't remember, but somehow her luggage and everything is on this bus.
Oh, no.
And I said to her, I said, how old are you? She's like 17 or something.
Wow.
And I said, well, do you have your purse? Do you have any? No, everything's on the bus. And I said to her, I said, listen, I'm going to find your luggage. But in the meantime, you know, where do you live? She said, well, I live in like Cincinnati or somewhere, Cleveland or somewhere in Ohio.
Somewhere in Ohio.
Probably where they met her the night before.
Probably.
And conned her into jumping
yeah.
on.
She probably didn't get the rabbit's foot from David Lee Roth.
No, she did not. So what happened? Or she did. And who knows?
It wasn't lucky.
All I know is everyone tried and everyone missed. So my buddies head home, and I'm still trying to sort out things with the hotel manager to get all that settled. And then I said to her, I said, well, what are you going to do? And she goes, I don't know. I said, well, then you're coming home with me because I can't leave you here. You don't have any money, any ID. So you're going to have to come home with me. I live in Detroit. And then what we're going to do is get your luggage. And then we're also going to get you back home.
Right.
So I call my buddy in Buffalo and said, dude, you need to do me a favor. When the bus shows up, I need you to hook up with Rudy and tell him what's going on and find her luggage.
Who's Rudy?
He was like one of the assistant road managers.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
So at the end of the day, they find her luggage. And I said, do me a favor, just put it on your credit card and ship it to her house.
Right.
And then I got her home and all my buddies took another swap at it, and I'll admit I took a swap at it too. But
did you get denied also?
No. Yeah. Well, bottom line is she was holding on to all of it.
Well, good.
And
good.
She wouldn't share it with anybody.
Good for her.
Good for her. So I end up driving her to the airport. And back then, I think it cost me like $125 or something to fly her out of my pocket.
Yeah.
I found a way to expense it, but at the end of the day, I had to get her home. And I said to her, I said, look, I know that you had thought you were doing the right thing. I said, but A, you're a very attractive girl, and B, these are rock and roll bands.
Right.
I hope you understand that all of these bands, this is a party on wheels.
Yeah.
And that's where their heads are at. And,
And just tell her to hang out for about 4 more years, and Motley Crue is going to write a song about her called Too Young to Fall in Love. So it's a little ahead of her time.
There you go. But, it ended up where, I got her home and we carried on. So there's one of my Van Halen stories. And the other one that I'd like to segue right into, because it was 1980.
Yeah.
Is this was the Women and Children First album. And this story I really love because David Lee Roth was such a showman that he thought through some of these shenanigans because I can't see how this wasn't pre-staged.
Right.
And after we did an interview with Ted Cohen and he brought up these girls too,
mm-hmm.
that confirmed it to me that these girls were part of a stage act in David's world, which meant they never made it on stage.
Right.
But what had happened is simply this. We're going to WABX in Detroit, which is a radio station that has, it's on like the third or fifth story of an office building in Detroit.
Right.
And the windows were floor-to-ceiling windows, all glass. And when we left the hotel, it's kind of like a rock and roll circus that everyone gets swept up into these limos. Mm-hmm. And there were several limos. And these two girls that were goth looking, black hair, white blouses, little black mini skirts,
mm-hmm.
and then they wore these black nylon stockings and they looked identical.
Yeah.
They got swooped into the limos as well. And then we hit the radio station and the crowd is already gathering to see the band because they've been talking about the fact they're coming to do an interview. So a lot of people that knew where the radio station was started hanging out in the parking lot.
Okay.
So we work our way past the crowd and hit the elevator and get up to the control room. And if you guys can take the time to go to that third album, Women and Children First,
mm-hmm.
The track Everybody Wants Some.
Right.
I mean, David Lee Roth, it's chaos, absolute chaos in the control room. And David Lee Roth tells the DJ, he goes, listen, I want you to cue up Everybody Wants Some. And so he does. And what's cool is everybody outside of their car doors opening and they are listening to the radio station, below.
Yeah.
And the crowd's getting bigger and thicker, and it's just amazing. So at one point where Alex gets into a very primitive kind of drumming break,
mm-hmm.
David calls the two girls over and he puts them both on either side of him with their bums facing the window. And then he literally pantomimes that how you say it?
Yeah,
pantomime. He pantomized the lyrics of I love the way the line runs up the back of your stocking. And he takes his fingers and goes all the way up.
Awesome.
You know, and kind of shows their bums, you know, to the crowd below. And it was amazing. It was like the coolest thing I've ever seen. And it all went down at the WABX radio station studios.
That's a great story.
For the third album. And so, Bruce, you can unmute now.
Yeah. Well, I hope that you and I get a chance to go see David Lee Roth in Vegas. And, you know, maybe he can recreate that for us.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you.
The only problem would be some of those 80-year-old waitresses from Caesars now. You know, that's the problem.
I have to tell you, that was one of my favorite Van Halen because we were all absolutely amazed at how flawless it went down.
Yeah.
You know, and I think David and the girls were the only ones that actually knew what was happening.
They just had it planned out.
Yeah.
That's great.
So we're turning into 1980. And in 1980, some of the albums that Warner Brothers had at that time was a Fleetwood Mac Live.
Yeah.
The Talking Heads' Remain in Light, which had the song Once in a Lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was doing a little research on this episode, and that was one album where both David Byrne and Chris Frantz had said that they took a financial beating on that album because
really?
It didn't sell as well as a lot of their other albums that are going to be coming out in the future. And the problem that they had felt was radio wasn't embracing it because they didn't know what it was because it had, you know, black radio was saying, well, it's white, and white radio saying, well, it's black, because they had a lot of African influence and a lot of cool things. But if you track Once in a Lifetime, it's a phenomenal song.
It is. Whose idea was it for the live Fleetwood Mac album? Because I had that album. I thought it was well done. There were some deeper tracks that I think I liked the live version more so than the studio tracks. But, I mean, was this just something to kind of fill some time? Because I know labels will record a live album and put it out there to kind of hold it over so they can record their next album. Was that the status for this or no?
No, that's exactly right. You're either going to have like a place marker with a greatest hits or a live album.
Right.
A greatest hits is very inexpensive because all the songs have already been produced.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of what kind of artwork you choose for the album cover and liner notes and whatnot. And remember, we're talking vinyl. And then live is going to be a little more expensive because you're going to have the production of the equipment for live. But they are exactly that. They're a bridge between studio albums most of the time.
Right. Okay.
And remember, ever since Peter Frampton Comes Alive came out, everybody wanted to do a live album because I think the other band that capitalized incredibly well off a live album was Cheap Trick, live from Budokan,
and also Kiss, who did the Alive and the Alive 2 albums about the same time, too, that they didn't get any radio airplay, but all of those albums were, you know, platinum selling.
You know, because they capture, if the show's captured the way the bands are hoping, there's something electric about those shows. Waiting on Columbus by Little Feat was my favorite Little Feat album, even though there's a lot of studio albums I enjoyed, because it captured the band very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you had going. But we also had the second Dire Straits album, Making Movies.
And I have to say, I like this album better than their debut.
You know, I listened to that today while I was writing this script, and Tunnel of Love.
Yeah.
I mean, what a great song.
And Making Movies, you know, that drum beat that leads into it is like it just kind of ramps up.
It's really good.
It's just such a cool
album. It was clear when that came out that that wasn't a one-hit wonder of Sultans of Swing.
Oh,
we
yeah.
knew right then and there that they were a long-haul band.
Yeah.
We also had brought out B-52's Wild Planet.
That had to be kind of interesting to walk into a pretty conservative program director and say, hey, I got this record for you called B-52s, this band B-52s. What do you think about this Rock Lobster song?
Yeah, but keep in mind, we already had D-E-V-O, Devo.
That's true.
Are We
that
Not
is true.
Men?
That is
you
true.
Know, so we had been assaulting them on a lot of levels of, what is this?
Yeah.
Well, even Tusk.
Yeah, that's true.
Tusk was such a different sounding piece of music that anyone was prepared for with Fleetwood Mac. Then we had Ramones do End of the Century. Prince had Dirty Mind.
Mm-hmm.
Echo and the Bunnymen was their debut album.
Another one, a great album, but I got to say, you know, some of those that just are not that open to that particular type of music at the time right. must have been like, what is this?
Well, you know? Well, how about my next one? I mean, remember, Warner Brothers had signed the Sex Pistols.
Yeah.
So here comes Public Image, LTD, or Pill.
Which I always like better than the Sex Pistols. Now, I'm sure I'll get a little grief on that, but I love that album.
Well, and then we had signed this band out of Ireland called U2.
Ooh, yes.
And their debut album was called Boy.
Right.
So let me tell you that story.
Yeah, let's go there.
Okay, so 1980, I was 1 foot in Detroit marketplace and 1 foot in Texas,
mm-hmm.
meaning that they gave me the go-ahead to transfer in January, February of 1980, but I literally didn't get into the Houston marketplace till June.
Right.
And I bought a home and all that sort of thing. So in between there, you know, I was going from one market to the other. So when I had the U2 show, I had them in Austin first. And the very first thing was I picked both Edge and Bono up, and I took them to KLBJ Radio.
Right.
Where the very first week that the song I Will Follow came out, there were three major stations in the country. Well, actually, I should say two. But three stations added it to their playlist. One was WBCN in Boston, which is a powerhouse.
Yeah.
One was KLBJ FM, and then one was KNCN in Corpus Christi.
Wow. So two of those Texas radio stations that you're referring to, for those who aren't up on the geography, that was you.
That was my territory. So I was right. pretty proud of that.
Right.
And we had talked about, you know, when you're passionate about a song, how you really try to get it's a game you play with your contemporaries.
Yeah.
You want to be the first one to get some of these records started.
Mm-hmm.
So they immediately started booking them to support this airplay. And, of course, college campuses were also kind of earmarked. So with Austin having the University of Texas
right.
and other universities surrounding it, they booked a show. And it was in a local club called Clubfoot.
Okay.
And Clubfoot had this Lincoln Continental shell as kind of like part of the bar or the back bar. It was kind of weird.
Right.
But it was cool. And it was in a old railroad warehouse where the railroad tracks were right in front of the building. And back in the day when the railroad was running through the city of Austin, they would probably load and unload, you know, goods
mm-hmm.
into this warehouse.
Wow.
So now it became this funky little bar. And what the band had done that day, I had told this story a lot of times in a lot of tour buses with other up-and-coming bands. Because I thought it was one of the most brilliant marketing strategies I've ever seen a band do. And what had happened is there was 100 kids, but you wouldn't ever know it because they were totally in on this band and they were so such participants in the show and they were just a great crowd. So the band comes on stage and they play I Will Follow right out of the chute.
Wow.
Very first track, which quite frankly was, for the most part, the only song anyone had heard.
Right.
Unless they went and bought the album right away.
Yeah.
So then they did the whole album. And I remember us going backstage and back then we always would wait for encores.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave the band a chance to, you know, drink some water, change their shirt, go to the bathroom, whatever they wanted to do. This was their break before they came back and, you know, finished the show.
Right.
And I remember Bono looking at the rest of the band and saying, "You guys ready?" And it was like, "Let's go." And they went back and played I Will Follow again. And I just thought...
So it was like bookends of the show.
It was like bookends of the show.
That's great.
And prior to that, earlier in the day, and maybe the reason we had a nice crowd is Tom Quarles, the late, great Tom Quarles, was the music director at KLBJ back in the day. And he did their radio interview, which could have been one of their very first yeah. ever. In the States, anyway. He was so well-versed on what to ask them and how to, you know, what questions would be interesting for them to answer instead of the same old stuff. And, right. And the band really responded to that. They got a kick out of the fact that a former president actually owned a rock and roll radio station. Yeah. So there was a lot of things that went on there that was really great, but that was a great, great thing.
Yeah.
And then another great story I could tell about 1980 was I was transferring from Michigan to Texas. So on the final leg, we're driving. We had everything packed in a big moving truck, even one of our cars. But it was where I was driving our car with the cat under the seat meowing most of the way. And we couldn't stop hearing Christopher Cross Sailing. I mean, we were picking it up on every single radio station all the way from Michigan to Texas. I mean, Missouri and wherever.
Yeah.
Well, as soon as I got to Texas, my first job was, there was an in-store setup at a record store called Sound Warehouse. It was a big chain back in the day in the South.
I remember.
There was Peaches, there was Harmony House up in the North, and so Sound Warehouse was a big chain down here.
Mm-hmm.
So Christopher Cross was a local boy. He lived in Austin, but he's born and raised in San Antonio, so he's gigged a lot here. Mm-hmm. The in-store was literally him signing autographs for the fans. So it was very well promoted, and there was this huge crowd. And I remember that there was a high school, like Crockett High School or some local high school, that brought the band out, the marching band. And while they're performing Ride Like the Wind, there's this massive hurricane coming from Houston. And I didn't Google hurricanes in 1980, but it was Alicia or something like that.
Right.
And I'm from Detroit. I don't know shit about hurricanes. But what I do know is that the sky turns like pea green.
Yeah,
it's scary. Getting very serious.
It's a serious energy in the air.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, the guys with their tubas are being blown to the parking lot. And the guys with the big bass drums, it's like watching them on ice being just carried across the parking lot, and everybody's scattering, you know, in different directions. And I'm kind of going, what is going on here?
Right.
I mean, unfortunately, we had to postpone that in-store because it got a little hairy from this.
I was just thinking about how many of these artists probably played the college circuit, and I'm a little jealous for those of you who are in college around 1980 here at the University of Texas, because I was in college at a little university in North Carolina, Western Carolina University. So UT gets U2, and we get Christopher Cross, who did not like playing in a small setting like Western Carolina University, and made it very clear that he would never come back and play that university again. That's the first and the last time that I ever saw Christopher Cross.
Well, I don't know if I should say this, but he's...
Oh, he's listening.
So he's...
Let's put it like this. He may be listening today, and he may retract that he ever said that, but as a very influential sophomore in college, I remember it really well because I was working at the campus radio station. We were so excited to have Christopher Cross, his songs blowing up, and he just kind of shits all over our university and hits the road.
All right, well, I got to tell you, so I get him in Houston.
Okay.
So I've got him in Houston as July.
Yeah.
And they're staying at the White Hall, which is, at the time, a very ritzy hotel in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And him and his wife are wearing mink coats. And I'm like, what? Because they are getting royalty checks now, and the checks are starting to roll in, and they are just spending it like crazy, to the point where he ended up investing a lot of money in Formula One race cars, which are expensive.
Sure.
And that became a hobby of his. And then artistically, he started really buddying up with Burt Bacharach and Carol Bayer Sager. Yeah. And I know that the higher ups at Warner Brothers are going, stop it. We have positioned you to be a rock and roll guy. In fact, that debut album had Don Henley as guest vocalist. We had Michael McDonald as guest vocalist.
Mm-hmm.
He had a local guitar virtuoso, Eric Johnson, on the album.
Didn't know that.
I think Nicolette did background vocals on a track.
Yeah, I think I do remember that.
So the album was rich with production and guest artists. And
won a ton of Grammys.
It was, at that moment in time, that album had won 5 Grammys. and which was the first time a debut album at that moment in time had won 5 Grammys.
Yeah, that was huge.
Best album, song of the year, record of the year, best accompaniment.
And I think best new artist, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. In fact, on our website, promotion-man.com, I will put the plaque that I had received with my name on it, you know, in there so you can see it.
He's heard us talk about him today. He may come over to your place and take it back.
You know, I had a run-in with him at a Roxy Music show or a Brian Ferry show. Oh,
that should have been fun right there in itself. It's too bad that Teddy Cohen wasn't with you. You guys could have had a brawl.
Yeah. Well, because I said to Chris, I said, hey, how you doing? And he said something. I said, you know, you may not remember me, but I helped break your album in the beginning. He said, yeah, I probably owe you all the credit.
Oh,
kinda
nice.
Like kind of like a douche. And I'm like, yeah, okay, it was nice to meet you too.
Right. Well, good luck.
So anyway, to round out our albums that we had had the U2 debut album. ZZ Top had Duguelo, which Cheap Sunglasses. There was a track on there called I Thank You, and the story was that Russ Thyrett, our vice president of promotion, had begged ZZ Top to do that song because he wanted to get as close to a cool ballad, which it's not necessarily a ballad, but it's, I guess, what you'd call a mid-tempo.
Kind of a cool groove.
Yeah. And then he had Bonnie Raitt do it on her album as well. Mm-hmm. And so really at the very same time, we had both Bonnie Raitt and ZZ Top redoing that really wonderful song called I Thank You.
I used to use I'm Bad, I'm Nationwide as my college radio theme song lead-in. So I just always wanted to be this syndicated guy, you know? It's just like, even back then when I was just a pup, I still would have I'm Bad, I'm Nationwide for my lead-in song.
Well, but let me ask you one question. Who doesn't like that song?
It's a great song.
I mean, I'm Bad, I'm Nationwide.
ZZ Top and Willie Nelson are the two entities that made me want to come to Texas. There's no doubt about it. It's just like I wanted to come to a 4th of July picnic with Willie, and I wanted to go, you know, boogie down with ZZ Top.
I remember we had put out bumper stickers, I'm Bad, I'm Nationwide, and it had a car on there, some kind of like old car. And I remember my dad, who is an old timer, I gave him a ZZ Top hat, like a baseball hat.
Right.
And he loved that hat, but he had no clue what it said or what it meant. I mean, I was giving him promo t-shirts of Van Halen and all these crazy t-shirts.
That's awesome.
And he wore them, but he had no idea what I was up
into.
To. So just to round out the show, I looked up the Rolling Stone magazine Best of the 80s.
Okay.
And they had actually compiled a lot of albums. I want to say like 500. And out of all of those...
Now, this is the best of the entire decade, not 1980. This is the best of the 80s.
Yeah, of the 80s.
Wow, okay.
And the Pretenders debut album was number 2.
Wow.
Talking Heads' Remain in Light was number 4.
Yeah.
Even though they had, you know, said it was a substantial expense or loss in the beginning.
Right.
B-52s came in at number 5.
That's crazy.
Prince Dirty Mind came in at number 7.
Now, you would think Purple Rain, maybe, or, you know, at least would be top 10 or 1999, but no, they went with Dirty Mind at number 7.
Echo and the Bunnymen, who you appreciated, came in at number 12.
That. Well, look at that. That's good.
Dire Straits, Making Movies, came in at number 25, and then I kind of stopped at that.
So Warner Brothers, it's safe to say, definitely was a huge influential record company in the, well, not only the 80s and the 70s also, but the 80s, they definitely really shined and came through.
Oh,
I mean, look at that.
I mean, I didn't even track like Madonna or some of the other.
You got 4
albums
in the top 10 that are at Warner Brothers artists.
I know.
That's amazing.
So anyway, I don't know if we've finished with 1980 as much as we've got a good start at 1980.
I would say I'm sure we'll dig up some more stuff to talk about 1980 because, again, it was that decade beginning. So, you know, there's always stuff I'm sure we'll find because 1980 still had a little bit of the 70s feel to it, but it was definitely starting to change, as you said, with Pretenders, B-52s, Talking Heads, U2. I mean, it was definitely different than what we'd heard from the arena rock of Van Halen in the 70s. So, but Van Halen figured out the 80s as well and did better in the 80s than they did in the 70s.
They did. And I'll be able to talk a little bit about their transition because come 1981 or 82, we signed Sammy Hagar as a solo artist because he was on Capitol.
Right.
So we'll talk about that as we navigate into 80, 81, 82.
So, Bruce, you'll have to endure some more Van Halen stories.
Thank you, because I was going to say that, but I'm glad you did. All right, we're over and we're out. Spread it.
I thought you were talking to me for a second. I didn't know if I needed to change my juxtaposition of the way I was sitting here in my chair or not.
That's it. I'm leaving.
Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider. We appreciate you subscribing and spreading the word, and thanks for listening.